Welcome to the All Sides Reporter Roundtable, an hour where we catch up on the political news of last week and preview the week ahead. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. And this week in the studio with me, Joe Ingles, reporter for the Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau. Welcome back, Joe.
Great to be here.
Haley B. Miller, state government and politics reporter at the Columbus Dispatch. Welcome back, Haley.
Happy Monday.
And Noah Blundo, reporter and editor at Hannah News Service. Welcome back, Noah.
Good morning.
So it's the press event that the whole world is talking about and wondering about the geopolitical fallout. We're talking about Friday's Oval Office press conference where President Trump and Vice President J.D. Vance scolded Ukrainian President Vladimir Zelensky for not being grateful enough for U.S. support and aid. And it truly was a remarkable scene.
What kind of diplomacy, J.D., you are speaking about? What do you mean?
I'm talking about the kind of diplomacy that's going to end the destruction of your country.
Yes, but if you
Mr. President, with respect, I think it's disrespectful for you to come into the Oval Office and try to litigate this in front of the American media. Right now, you guys are going around and forcing conscripts to the front lines because you have manpower problems. You should be thanking the president for trying to bring an end to this conflict.
All right. So, Joe, current and past Ohio leaders have been reacting over the weekend to that heated exchange that took place Friday in the Oval Office. What are they saying?
Well, U.S. Senator Bernie Moreno sided with President Trump and J.D. Vance, saying, you know, this is what needs to happen. And Zelensky needs to follow suit and do what the president asked him to. We've seen some other talk online from members of the Congress about it. But, you know, largely, I think that in some ways, the verdict is out. Because there's been a lot of clips. That clip you just played, everyone's probably seen that all weekend, you know, because we're getting fed that. But in total, that whole interchange was about 45 minutes long. People have not seen it in total. And, you know, it's really, we're at a state with this, with that news conference, what happened. It was very important. It says a lot about American policy and the direction that they want to head. And, you know, a lot of people they aren't even on the radar yet. They're not watching TV. They're not reading newspapers. They're not listening to NPR or you know, places where they will get a true kind of sense of what's going on. And, you know, this is something that people need to perk up and pay attention to, because this is, you know, a shift in some ways from what we've had in the past. And I think a lot of the lawmakers, especially the Congress, a lot of them are kind of, you know, putting their finger in the air to see where the wind is with folks before they really jump in with all 2 feet and go under.
Haley, what do you want to add?
It's interesting. I feel like the reaction in a lot of ways underscores how much of an evolution we've seen with Ohio Republicans, because, you know, Joe mentioned Moreno. There were other Republicans who are currently in office that I think are generally on board. But then we have folks like Governor Mike DeWine, former Senator Rob Portman. These are Republicans in Ohio who were very pro-Ukraine, very anti-Russia, have made it clear that Russia is the antagonizer in this war. And so it's interesting to see that shift, and that's played out in this reaction. Another former kind of old school Republican who chimed in was former Governor John Kasich. He called the exchange shameful. So I just think it shows how much the Republican Party has changed in general, but particularly on foreign policy.
Some news reports are questioning why Vice President J.D. Vance, Ohio's own J.D. Vance, was even in the room. Haley, you watched Vance on the campaign trail. And what do you think of his first few weeks in this VP role, of how, what compared to him as our senator?
You know, I think it's pretty par for the course for him. We've seen him take on this role of really being a spokesperson for the White House in a lot of ways. He's very articulate. He's always been able to deliver the MAGA message in a way that, you know, perhaps is more compelling to certain audiences. And I think Ukraine, especially, I think his presence in that meeting makes a lot of sense, only because from the very beginning of his political career, going back to when he ran for Senate, he was not interested in U.S. assistance for Ukraine. He pretty famously said he doesn't really care what happens in Ukraine one way or the other. So I think how he's approached the VP role is really just a logical extension of what we saw from him when he was our senator.
Noah, what's your take?
I think the president sets the tone for many people in the Republican Party. And so as soon as that conflict hit the airwaves, you saw a rally around the flag effort.
And I would also add that President Trump and Vice President Vance got what they wanted. I mean, they got the United Kingdom and France are getting together. They're talking about a different way to approach Ukraine, which I think is what he wanted.
Yeah. You know, the thing that was really kind of stunning to me when I watched the whole tape is how little Marco Rubio said. I thought, you know, in his position,
I didn't know he was in the room at first. Yeah.
Yeah. But you would expect him in that position to speak up and say something. And he really didn't say much at all. He just kind of sat there next to Vance.
Yeah. And if you watch, I mean, the whole 45 minutes, I mean, it runs the gamut. They taught everything happened, even down to someone in the press criticizing what Zelensky was wearing.
Yeah, that was odd. I can't imagine anyone in the Ohio press ever doing anything like that. But, you know.
His reaction was that he would wear a suit once the war was over. Something like that.
Yeah, something like that.
Well, I guess we'll have to see what happens and see how this all plays out. We're going to move on to some Ohio politics. I guess all politics is everything. But recently, Haley, the Dispatch broke the story that Intel's $28 billion chip factory won't be online for 5 or 6 more years. The Dispatch in an editorial called the move alarming. So what reason did the company give for such another delay? I mean, there's been delay after delay, but this is another and this is the biggest delay.
Yeah, Intel has been struggling with its finances as of late. And so, you know, they attribute it to that. They said that more time will allow them to, you know, get their footing and ensure this project is going to work as designed. But it raises a lot of questions about the future of the project in general and, you know, Intel's ability to make good on this promise to bring a lot of jobs to Central Ohio. And of course, the state has a lot of money on the line here as well.
Joe, everyone on your team has been following Intel for years. Mm-hmm. There was news earlier this month that they were looking to sell to one of their competitors from Taiwan. What do you make of this big delay?
Well, you know, there's been a lot of changes at Intel. If you look from Gelsinger stepping down, you know, the talk of the sale and the different changes at the top. It's been kind of volatile because Intel has had some problems. I mean, budgets have been tighter than they thought they were going to be. What I make of it is that we really don't know what's going to happen with this situation. But as far as the agreements that Ohio has made with Intel, obviously they're off schedule. You know, they're going to have to go in and look at those and kind of figure out, are they still, you know, meeting the benchmarks, the thresholds? Do we need to change that and that kind of thing? And I think that's where Ohio lawmakers, or at least governors and Jobs Ohio and that kind of, they'll be looking at those kind of things.
Noah?
Yeah, some of this stuff is performance-based, so, you know, some things can be tied to how many jobs they actually created. So the state is not necessarily on the hook right now for every bit of assistance as promised, but they're not going to unwidened the roads that we've widened. We're not going to tear water pipes out of the ground. A certain amount of money has already been committed, regardless of how big these plants end up being and how many chips and jobs come out of them.
Yeah. And, you know, the thing is that all those things you mentioned, Noah, those, if Intel doesn't end up going in and using as much space and doing their plan as they thought they might, if things do change, that's still a marketable property for someone. Mm-hmm. And so, putting infrastructure in for businesses and growth, that always comes back to be a positive, usually in some way, for the state.
I talked with a Licking County commissioner before this delay was announced. It was a few weeks before that. And he said something very similar. He was like, either way, something is going to happen in Licking County in that big giant building. Mm-hmm. So he said that Licking County will win in the end.
Yeah, it's hard to imagine that they would just let all of that existing infrastructure go to waste. And especially, I think we're seeing that Ohio has become more and more competitive for these large developments. You know, Anduril's just now coming in. And so I think, you know, there will be opportunity. Of course, Intel has gotten a lot of attention. It was a big win in a lot of ways for Governor DeWine and now Senator John Husted. So it'll probably, you know, if it doesn't work out, not the end of the world, but it might hurt some feelings a little.
What do you make of, you know, former Lieutenant Governor, now Senator John Husted, wanted Ohio to be the Silicon Heartland, and Intel was the big, you know, staple point in the middle of that. That's what started getting calling us that. I mean, does this ruin that plan?
I don't know. I guess we got to see what comes out of it in the end. I mean, is it going to be the heart, or is it maybe going to be a kidney, or I don't know. You know, it's like you don't know what's going to happen with it, so it's hard to answer that.
But our producer, Erin Rabinowitz, she pulled a few comments from a Facebook group that follows the project, and, you know, there's a range of reaction. One commentator said, if the earth opened up and swallowed the whole thing, I would call that a pretty good day for our county. So some of them are just like, okay, let's and then they say, you know, thanks a lot, boys in office. Again, more delays.
Well, and, you know, here's the thing. If you live out there in that area, you still don't have the roads where you want them to be for that many people. You don't have the mass transit where you want it to be for that many people. It's not like it's sitting there completely finished just waiting for Intel to come in. I mean, there's work being done in that
area. It's been
area.
Disruptive for and people living there.
It has been disruptive for people living there. So, you know, there's another side to the story that we didn't mention before, and that's it.
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. This is our reporter roundtable. We're talking with Noah Blundo, reporter and editor at Hannah News, Joe Ingles, reporter for the Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau, and Haley B. Miller, state government and politics reporter at the Dispatch. So let's turn to the governor's race, and let's turn to who may be leading the state. Who may be leading the state when and if the Intel project ever opens. Let's listen.
I am honored to announce my candidacy to serve as the next governor of the state of Ohio.
That is Republican Vivek Ramaswamy with what sounds like a large crowd jumping into the governor's race last week. And he quickly earned the endorsement from President Donald Trump. Was anyone surprised at how quickly Trump endorsed him? Normally he waits a little bit, but it was the same day.
Yeah, I was surprised. I don't think the Trump endorsement was ever a question, despite some reported friction between Ramaswamy and Elon Musk in the White House. But yeah, it happened fast. And, you know, I think I'd be curious if, you know, the vice president had any influence over that, knowing kind of how Ohio Republican primaries work. But it definitely signals that, you know, Trump and Ramaswamy and, you know, their allies are trying to put this primary to bed sooner rather than later. And it makes sense in some ways because Ohio's had some pretty ugly Republican primaries.
And do you feel like, Joe, that this is, you know, Trump put his thumb on the scale and the race is over before it even began? Does Attorney General Dave Yost have a chance?
You know, Karen is my colleague, Karen Kassler, is going to talk with Dave Yost, I believe, later today. It's sometime soon about this. But I don't know that Yost has another lane to veer his car into, because he'd be too old under Ohio law to be a Supreme Court justice. And exactly where do you go if you're not going toward governor? But I think we're all forgetting that this is a year from now. And look at how much has been going on in just a month. We've had a whole bunch of stuff happening. We've got an economy that could very well be different next year at this time than it is right now. So there, you know, yes, right now, you know, President Trump is very popular with Ohioans, and Vivek Ramaswamy would be popular because of that endorsement. But how does that play a year from now if we don't have a strong economy, if things don't go well? I mean, I just think we're too quick to say, well, he's got Trump's endorsement and we're going to write it off. I there are other positions there.
I know, us silly media. Why do we say these things? That was me. I said it.
I think a lot of people have said it, Amy. Yes. It's not just you. And I think I've probably said it, to be quite honest. So
yes. Noah, go ahead.
Yeah. Well,
I'm here making fun of myself. But go ahead. No, yeah.
We also have a new lieutenant governor, and we have no idea.
Oh, yeah. Who's that guy?
Jim
I forgot.
Pressel.
Yeah. What's his name again?
Yeah. So as far as somebody who could jump into the race and have as much name ID in the state of Ohio as the president has or something. I mean, he's, you know, pun intended, he's playing it close to the vest. He hasn't said anything about it. I'm focused on today and learning as much as I can about this. But, you know, it just, like Joe said, it's more than a year from now when people would actually be voting in that Republican primary. We don't know what the economy will be like. We don't know how Vivek could be bloodied up by whatever. You know, he hasn't really been scrutinized that intently as he would be, you know, over the course of the next year. And I don't think Dave Yost is going to roll over just yet. Mm-mm. He has been, you know, he waited his turn to run for attorney general for 8 years. Now he's waited his turn to run for governor. You know, he's not getting any younger. So I think he's going to think long and hard before he just decides to throw in the towel.
Haley, do you think that the lieutenant governor pick of Jim Tressel was strategic on DeWine's part? Do you feel like he was hoping maybe Tressel would give Ramaswamy a run for his money?
You know, I never know what goes on in that man's head sometimes.
Meaning DeWine?
DeWine, yes.
I was like, which one? Any of them.
I think that's definitely a possibility. DeWine is very focused on his own legacy right now, and it's probably difficult for him to some extent because he had handpicked his successor for governor. It was Husted, and then when the Senate appointment came up, you know, there was a lot of behind the scenes chatter and various dominoes, you know, that fell. And, you know, while I think DeWine was happy to appoint Husted to the Senate, it really took out of his hands the ability to perhaps influence the next governor's race. So Tressel could be an attempt to do that. But I still think we don't really know a lot about Tressel's personal ambitions. And, you know, time will tell.
All right. Well, when we come back from the break, we're going to talk about a few of the promises that Ramaswamy made in his campaign speech and how he's going to pull some of those off. That is when All Sides continues with the Reporter Roundtable on 89.7 NPR News.
Each morning, it's a new opportunity, a chance to start fresh. Up First from NPR makes each morning an opportunity to learn and to understand. Choose to join the world every morning with Up First, a podcast that hands you everything going on across the globe and down the street, all in 15 minutes or less. Start your day informed and anew with Up First by subscribing wherever you get your podcasts.
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. I'm Amy Jurevich, and this is the weekly Reporter Roundtable, where we talk all things Ohio politics. With me in the studio, Noah Blundo, reporter and editor for Hannah News Service, Joe Ingles, reporter for the Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau, and Haley B. Miller, state government and politics reporter at the Columbus Dispatch. Now, I mentioned that we would talk a little bit more about Vivek Ramaswamy because he toured the state, he gave many speeches, he had many plans of what he was going to be doing if he becomes governor. So he covered quite a bit of ground in announcing his bid. He walked to the podium to the refrain, "This is how legends are made," was being played. And then here is what he had to say about taxes.
We need to bring down the income tax eventually down to zero because you deserve to keep what you earn. It is your money, not the government's. We need to bring down property taxes in this state immediately, eventually down to zero. If you own land, it should not feel like it's a lease from the government.
All right, Joe. So he wants to get rid of all the taxes. Not all.
Yeah.
Well, a lot of important ones. Where's he going to make up the money? What taxes does he want to get rid of?
Exactly. So you can't get rid of all of them because you're going to have some money to run the government. And, you know, even if you pare down the government and you get rid of certain things, you're still going to have the things that you need to fund in the state. Just like every other state, the ones have gotten rid of the income tax, they still have to fund their state. So that leaves, what do you tax? Where do you tax? You know, a lot of people suggest a use or a sales tax. Well, we already have, 7.5% in Delaware County or 8%? Well, I don't know what we're at. But anyway, we already have a pretty significant sales tax right now. And, you know, how are people going to feel if that goes up to 15% to make up for, you know, all the other taxes that have been cut? And, you know, if you look at the income tax, that is a tax that's based on your income. So if you're lower income, you may pay nothing or, you know, pay little. But if you're a higher income, you pay more. Mm-hmm. And that's set up that way. But if you start looking at sales taxes, fees, uses, that use tax, when you start looking at that, then you're going to be everyone paying the same thing. So it's, you know, when you pull your car in to gas it up, or you pull, that's not a good thing because that's a transportation budget. But, you know, you pull in, you get your groceries, and you're paying taxes on the non-food items on your groceries. They're not going to say, well, now what's your income? I'm going to, you know, figure out what your tax is owed. Mm-hmm. They're going to take an amount, and it may play different for different people.
Yeah. Haley?
It's worth noting that, you know, this debate about whether to get rid of the income tax has come up a lot in the legislature. There are Republican lawmakers who want to do this. Over the past several years, Republicans have slowly been, you know, condensing the tax brackets and that kind of thing. But when you think about this and you think about, okay, where does the state get the money? You know, other states that have eliminated their income tax or significantly reduced it, you know, like Nevada has a whole gaming industry in Vegas. Mm-hmm. Some of these other states have really robust tourism that Ohio, frankly, just doesn't have. So
we don't have Disney World. So
we do not. Yeah. So it's just, it gets tough, again, unless you're just going to raise the sales tax on literally everyone. But even still, I mean, that's just property taxes and income taxes. That's a lot of revenue.
Yes. Noah?
Yeah. During the Kasich administration, they actually did bump the sales tax up slightly in order to finance income taxes. Reducing the income tax, reducing the number of brackets, bringing the rates down has been Republican dogma for the last dozen years or so. They have, every budget have gradually brought it down, but it's still several billion dollars a year. You know, the sales tax is the dominant tax, but income tax is not that far behind. The next biggest source of revenue, the commercial activity tax, brings in nowhere near either of those. And the legislature recently has even, they raised, I think, the threshold under which you even have to start paying the CAT, exempting. So they're shrinking the base of that. So, you know, where you replace the revenue or what kind of spending cuts you need to make in response is a tricky question. Well, and a lot of stuff gets funded at the local level by property
taxes.
That's what I was
just gonna
Not
say.
Just your schools. There are senior services levies. There are children's services
libraries.
Levies.
Yeah.
Libraries. You know, Developmental Disabilities Board, Mental Health, Behavioral Health, Addiction Services Boards.
Yeah, people forget what tax actually funds. And it's helpful if you sit down and make a list of the things that your tax dollars go for. And then you see that there's a whole lot of stuff out there that would still need to be funded if you went down to zero tax. You would still need to figure out how to pay for those things, no matter how much you cut the red tape, unless you just want to do without those things. But I think the significant portion of the population would say, no, we're not going to do without that.
It is, I mean, a smart campaign play by Ramaswamy, though. Is it realistic? No, but it's, no one likes taxes, and especially with the property taxes, that's been a really big issue for Ohioans the past few years. You know, increases in home valuations really hit a lot of people hard. So probably for those voters, if they're hearing, oh, we're just going to get rid of property taxes, I mean, I'm sure it sounds great to them.
Until about 10 years ago, it used to be that the state actually paid a larger portion of everyone's property taxes. There were these rollbacks that were basically the state government saying, we'll pay 10% of the bill or whatever, and they curtailed that about 10 years ago. So that, you know, that cutting property taxes and cutting income taxes can be in conflict in that way.
I just had a friend who was listening to the show, and she texted me, and she was from one of those states that have no income tax. Mm. And she said when they went to that model, then they started taxing the bejesus out, you know, with the excise tax and all these other things. And she said that they ended up paying, you know, she's a middle income taxpayer. She said they ended up paying a lot more because of what they had to do to offset.
Energy taxes are also another thing that some other states relied on, but the legislature here has not been amenable to increasing those recently.
Well, and in Ramaswamy's speeches that he made in his opening remarks, he did not mention Democratic gubernatorial candidate Dr. Amy Acton by name. He referenced her in relation to the pandemic. He said, never again will we bend a knee to an Anthony Fauci knockoff who allowed public schools to be closed. She owes those kids an apology. So he was obviously talking about Dr. Acton without saying her name. But Dr. Acton has been running a quiet campaign so far. Did she have any public response to Ramaswamy entering the race?
She did. She came out and said that he was a poor choice and that, you know, it was not a real strong kind of comment, though. She just said that, you know, he was wrong on the issues and that she looked forward to having a debate with him, which brings up another issue. Are there going to be debates in the governor's campaign? I mean, mm-hmm. who knows? Mm-hmm. So
this is the Weekly Reporter Roundtable. I'm Amy Jurevich, and with us in the studio is Haley B. Miller from the Columbus Dispatch, Joe Ingles with the Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau, and Noah Blundo from Hanna News Service. And Ohioans have been showing their displeasure with all of the head-spinning changes the Trump administration has been enacting. Moves at the federal and state level to end diversity, equity, and inclusion programs have been being met with opposition. Now, Joe, there's the controversial higher ed bill, Senate Bill 1. It's now being taken up in the Ohio House, and it passed the Senate. In my view, it passed pretty quickly. Mm-hmm. Tell us about the track for Senate Bill 1. Is it getting hearings this week in the House?
I haven't looked at the House calendar. I think it is.
Noah's shaking his head. I think it is being heard this week in the House.
Yeah, so. But we kind of know from talking to House Speaker Matt Huffman that a lot of the House members are backing this idea. So, you know, if that's the case and they have support, I mean, it's a Republican House. If all the Republicans vote for it, then it can obviously pass. But, you know, the question becomes, what are the changes that are made to the Senate plan during that process? And we don't really know that at this point, but there does seem to be support for the general idea of it.
Now, this higher education bill does a lot of things. It covers everything from what professors can teach to ending diversity, equity, and inclusion programs. And I know that there's a big protest plan for tomorrow. It's called a day of action where students and maybe faculty, I'm not sure exactly how big this protest is getting, are going to be going to the State House. Have you heard about this happening tomorrow?
Yeah, I heard about that. And I think, you know, there were similar issues at the University of Cincinnati when they announced that they were axing their DEI programs. That prompted a lot of protests. UC has since walked some of that back. But, you know, students, faculty are all very frustrated by what's happening at schools right now. And, you know, in a lot of ways, it's a response to Senate Bill 1. But I think more so it's a response to the Trump administration and the policies that are, you know, coming down from there. There was that Dear Colleague letter that went out a couple weeks ago that basically said, you know, universities get rid of these programs or else. So I think you're going to see a lot of people speaking up on campuses, you know, not just in Ohio, but across the country.
Yeah, not just citing the, you know, Senate Bill 1, this higher education bill, but also citing that the federal requirements of eliminating DEI. Ohio State is closing 2 diversity, equity, and inclusion offices and eliminating 16 staff positions. Now, before that announcement was made, we had a show. The day before that announcement was made, we had a show on DEI, and one of the guests was Ohio State University Professor Hassan Kwame Jeffries, and he criticized President Ted Carter for not using his influence for a different outcome.
Don't pretend like you don't know what this is, because then that's incompetence. Don't pretend like you can't fight and stand up for this, because then that's cowardice if you don't. And if you agree with this and are pretending that you don't, then you are being complicit.
So he was basically saying that Ted Carter, as the leader of Ohio State, the biggest university in the state of Ohio, should be fighting against what they're doing at the federal level and at the state house. Joe, what do you make of those comments?
Well, you know, yeah, I mean, I think there's a certain segment of the population who isn't buying into the arguments that are being made by the Republicans, and they want to see a fight. We just saw, last week there were more protests in other areas over DEI. We've seen it at the state house before when the Senate bill was coming through. It's a real issue, and we've also seen attempts to boycott some of the companies that have gotten away with their DEI and given it away. And so it's a big question. A lot of students say they don't want to go to a university that has rid themselves of DEI, that kind of thing. So I don't know. It's still an open book. I don't know how we judge that, actually.
And Noah, this bill moving through the legislature, I mean, it's not just about DEI. It bans faculty strikes. It impacts tenure. There's more in there.
There's a big labor relations piece to it. And, they negotiated away the strike ban in the prior General Assembly mm-hmm. session where this bill stalled out. And then they brought it back. There's reviews of faculty who have already gotten tenure. There's a procedure for, retrenchment, staff cuts and elimination of degree programs and stuff. So it is much more than just the DEI portions of it. So that's part of why it's so controversial as well.
And I think, we all have short memories, myself included sometimes. So I think for those who don't pay close attention to state government, it could appear that, Senate Bill 1 is a response to the Trump administration. But Ohio Republicans have been waging this fight separately, for a few years now.
Yeah.
Do you expect any changes? Will the House make any changes? I mean, would it lighten it or make it heavier? I'm trying to say a heavier bill. I don't know what I mean, but
it stalled out in the last session. Part of that may have been the rivalry between the then Speaker of the House, Jason Stevens, and Matt Huffman, who was then Senate President and is now. But it's hard to disentangle that from, the other objections to the bill. So, until we see, what pace it takes in the House, whether they'll just, it only took the Senate a few weeks mm-hmm. Of hearings, they did make some changes, but they were not overwhelming. So, if this stretches into a fourth and fifth and sixth hearing and we get multiple substitute bills or something, that might be an indication that, it's not as smooth of sailing.
There was a lot of testimony against it. Do they have to allow, I don't know what the rules are of how much testimony they have to allow. Is it, do they have to allow a certain number of people to testify against it if they want to? Or?
I think they can let whoever they want mm-hmm. testify against it. I think their policy has been on this, at least, to allow people to testify, but then they only give them like 3 minutes or something. And so they have to get up there and do a very short testimony. And a lot of these, if you sit through this testimony, you realize that a lot of the people who get up, they're all saying the same thing. Mm-hmm. So you don't get, all these people. But I think there were, 700? Am I wrong, guys? About 700 testified against it in the Senate.
It went for several hours, that hearing that they set aside for opposition testimony. I think a couple hundred at least spoke in person, and several hundred mm-hmm. submitted, because you can also just submit written comments. Or sometimes you might show up to testify thinking you'll have to wait a couple hours and, it's actually 8 hours and I have to go to work or I have to pick up my kids from school or whatever. So.
Hmm. All right. Well, we will see what happens to that higher education bill as it moves its way through the House. And we'll be back with more of the Reporter Roundtable in just a moment. This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News.
Each morning, it's a new opportunity, a chance to start fresh. Up First from NPR makes each morning an opportunity to learn and to understand. Choose to join the world every morning with Up First, a podcast that hands you everything going on across the globe and down the street, all in 15 minutes or less. Start your day informed and anew with Up First by subscribing wherever you get your podcasts.
This is All Sides and the Weekly Reporter Roundtable. I'm Amy Jurevich on 89.7 NPR News. And with us in the studio is Noah Blundo from Hannah News Service, Joe Ingles from the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau, and Haley B. Miller with the Columbus Dispatch. So when Vivek Ramaswamy announced that he was running for governor, he echoed Trump's talking points when it comes to government waste, saying that the country should not be run by unelected bureaucrats in the deep state. And he was also talking about the people who work for federal and state government, and he made lots of references to that. Well, in reaction to all of that, Ohio Secretary of State Frank LaRose, he introduced Ramaswamy, making a pitch of his own candidacy. Frank LaRose is running for state auditor, and he praised the work of Trump's Department of Government Efficiency, and he said that he would make Ohio's own Department of Government Efficiency a DOGE for Ohio if elected state auditor.
The auditor of state has the power to go into local and state government entities and do a performance audit to find out where they're overstaffed, using bad technology, just wasting time on stupid, outdated processes. And so I'm looking forward to bringing ODOGE, Ohio DOGE, to our state.
ODOGE. All right. So something to look forward to if Frank LaRose is elected auditor. I don't think anyone would disagree that there's probably waste and inefficiency in the government. So, but what do you make of the idea of an ODOGE, Joe?
One person's waste is another person's bread and butter. So, I mean, I think a lot of things are a waste that, you know, other people enjoy, so or need even. So that's very much in the eyes of the beholder. But let's get past that. I mean, the fact is that Republicans for generations have been, you know, saying they're the party of, you know, small government. Let's leave it to the locals to decide. Let's leave it, you know, to the states to decide. And a lot of these local communities, they're not, we have 88 counties in this state. And in each of those 88 counties, the needs are different. The counties operate differently. The needs of the taxpayers in those areas are different. There's a lot going on in Ohio. It's not like we're all sitting here with farm, you know, in farm country. It's not like we're all in a city. So if he goes in with DOGE, it would be really interesting as a reporter to cover, to try to watch those be made, because, you know, you'd really have to drill down in that. But I also think we need to remember Frank LaRose is running for auditor, and right now DOGE is popular with Trump and, you know, with Republicans, and he's going to need to get through a primary.
Noah, what do you make? Do you think Ohio needs a DOGE?
Performance auditing in the auditor state's office is nothing new. The last two or three auditors have talked about expanding performance auditing, and they have done so. And I, you know, they're always talking about adding staff to beef it up. And you know, it's kind of a routine.
Add staff to cut other staff.
Yeah, you know, there's multiple functions of the auditor's office. First, you know, they go in and they check the receipts to make sure that you're spending the money in line with with what the purpose of the appropriation was, and that, you know, you have checks and balances so that people can't embezzle and things like that. And then there's the performance auditing side. So I guess it doesn't strike me as anything new, particularly. It's just putting the branding of the day on something that already happens.
Yeah. And Haley, the idea that, you know, Frank LaRose, he's currently Secretary of State. Now he's running for auditor. This is just a part of the musical chairs where we talked about this earlier. Everyone waiting their turn and getting their seat. And is that what this is for Frank LaRose, a new seat?
Yeah. And I mean, this is really all that's left for him. This is like his third choice job probably at this point. But it's what's available.
Meaning he wanted to be governor. I don't even remember.
He wanted
now
to be senator. There was talk about him maybe getting a job in the Trump administration. Mm. So, you know, it's what he has before him, and a lot of Republicans are also, you know, making this same shift because they're all term limited and term limited at the exact same time. So, you know, that's why you see Treasurer Sprague running for Secretary of State now, and Keith Faber, the current auditor, is running for Attorney General. And so I think we're probably going to see a lot of the same faces in winning elections in 2026, just for different jobs.
And Joe, earlier you mentioned that this is still a long time away. This election is far away, right? But we're talking about it a lot now. But when will some Democratic candidates for these lower level offices below governor pop up?
That is the question of the day, Amy. I've been asking that for a while now, and we are not seeing a rapid pace of candidates. We have Brian Hambley, who came in, he's running for Secretary of State, I believe.
Yeah,
right?
he's a cancer doctor.
Yes,
yeah.
He's a cancer doctor, Cincinnati area, I believe. And last week we saw Elliot Forehand, who was a former Ohio lawmaker in the House. He had there were a lot of things that happened around Elliot Forehand, and you know, questions. He had problems, run-ins with the leaders of the House and with Dave Yost, and allegations were made, and, you know, investigations, whatever. And there are still some fallout from all of that. But he came in and said, yes, he wants to run for treasurer. So we've seen that. But, you know, we have not seen a farm team from the Democrats. I mean, I think that's what, you know, you talk about the Republicans and you can name, you know, five potential people for each post, right? But if you do that with the Democrats, they just don't have the farm team that the Republicans have. And maybe that's because, you know, they've been in the minority for a long time.
Well, we'll see. We have this reporter roundtable every Monday, so maybe by next Monday we'll have a Democratic name. I don't know. One of these Mondays we will. So let's talk about the transportation budget a little bit. An $11 million transportation budget passed the House last week with bipartisan support. I want to emphasize that. So it now heads to the Senate. It covers highway construction, public transportation, airport maintenance for the next 2 years. Noah, what are some highlights in this transportation budget?
There was a lot of discussion about the role of the BMV in getting people's voter registration updated, and the idea that you don't necessarily want them prompting people. So there's, you know, there are driver's licenses that will list and say you're not a citizen on there, but there was concern that like the BMV was being asked to ask everyone to update their voter registration, even if it said right there on the ID, this person is not a citizen. So they put in something specified, say, don't ask that question if the ID says this. There's a few hundred million dollars of, you know, new capacity, new highway construction, driver's education changes that the governor had asked for.
Go ahead, Joe.
I want to make one correction. I think I just said Elliot Forehand was running for treasurer. Is that what I said? Okay. If I said that, scratch that. He's running for attorney general. Okay.
Yes.
So everyone, you know.
Correct. Record corrected.
Record corrected. But, you know, the one thing about this, back to the transportation bill that we're talking about here, the one thing about it that struck me was the change in the way that they're going to process as voter registrations. Right now, when you go to the to get your license, the person at the BMV says, do you want to register to vote? Well, apparently, a lot of people who are not qualified to register to vote say yes, and they get registered, and it causes confusion. So this actually has a mechanism to straighten that out, because they wouldn't ask you to register to vote if you weren't able to vote.
Hmm. Not just if you're not a citizen, but maybe like they're asking a 16-year-old. Is that? Or,
well, no, it would be. Well, I guess that could be. I guess that could be. But
this does stem
citizen.
From all of the brouhaha over, you know, non-citizen voting in Ohio, which we know is very rare. But Secretary of State Frank LaRose has, you know, made a big push against that, as has Attorney General Dave Yost. And, you know, last year, Yost accidentally indicted a dead guy for illegal voting. But, you know, this is an extension of, you know, a debate that was really intense during the 2024 election cycle.
All right. So the transportation budget is now in the Senate. And there is another bill that I wanted to get an update on. Haley, the Ohio Senate passed a bill that would impose mandatory jail time for passengers who smoke marijuana in a car. This was new. I hadn't heard that they were I mean, we did a whole show on the marijuana bill, but different. This is different.
Yeah, this marijuana legislation, you know, this goes back to, you know, Republicans wanting to change the voter approved law that went into effect in 2023. They're trying again. And I mean, this bill would do a lot. The jail sentences are part of it. An original version of it looked at the taxes and revenue distribution for marijuana, but that's going to get punted to the budget now. So, but this would do things like reduce how much people can grow at home. You can't like gift homegrown marijuana under this bill. It does a whole lot of stuff. So it goes to the House next.
So this provision is mandatory jail time for a passenger who smokes marijuana in a car.
Which is not currently, you know, there's OVI laws on the books for people who drive under the influence of anything, but this would penalize people who are in a passenger of any vehicle and smoking or vaping. First offense would be a required 3-day jail sentence, and then it just goes up from there if you've been like a repeat offender. So, you know, could goes up to like 10 days, even like a year in prison if you've been really doing this a lot. But it is, some people I've talked to say that this is, you know, counter to the spirit of legalization because you're creating more penalties for something that just became legal.
Okay. Is this because people, I'm sorry, I know it's your job to ask the questions, but I'm curious. Is this because people think you can get a contact high if you're sitting in the car? Is that what it is? I don't know what
I would assume so, because it's specifically smoking and vaping. It doesn't say anything about like what happens if a passenger pops an edible.
Okay.
All right. Well, we are running out of time, but I did want to quickly talk about Medicaid. NOAA, the Ohio Department of Medicaid director, Maureen Corcoran, told a committee last week that potential federal cuts to Medicaid would impact more than just the expansion program. So everyone's worried about federal cuts, and Ohio would have to make up a lot of money if we lose federal funding, right?
Yeah, so the budget that the governor's office introduced includes two trigger provisions. One of them says that if the federal government share of Medicaid expansion coverage drops below 90%, then Ohio is out. We cut off those 700,000 or 800,000 people. Mm-hmm. We're out. But there's also just another more general purpose trigger that says if the feds cut, eliminate, reduce, suspend, pause, a bunch of other, you know, words of that nature, then Ohio also is able to follow suit. So if we have a program that's 80% federal funded and the feds say, we're going to only fund 60% of it now, the state can scale down, back out as needed. We'll see how that survives in the budget process. But I mean, when you talk about, you know, Medicaid just puts an immense amount of money into Ohio's healthcare economy, children's hospitals, nursing homes and stuff. So there would be a big fallout from just large scale cutbacks in Medicaid spending without something to replace it.
Yeah. Joe, it would leave a lot of people struggling with insurance coverage. Yeah,
yeah, I've heard that, you know, more than half of the kids in Ohio are on Medicaid. So you start thinking, and I'm not sure what the percentage is, but you start thinking about all the kids that might be affected. It's considerable. Who takes care of that then? Is it the parents don't have the money to take care of it. So who's going to, you know, take care of that?
And we have about 1 minute left, Haley, but can you talk about the work requirement part of the Medicaid?
Yeah, so Governor Mike DeWine has been asking for this for a while. He wants to impose a work requirement on the program. So people 55 and younger, I believe, would have to prove that they worked, I think, at least 20 hours a week or that they qualified for an exception. And that request is currently before the Trump administration.
All right. Well, I think we are just about out of time. So I want to thank you so much for joining us today. This has been the Weekly Reporter Roundtable from All Sides, and I'm Amy Jurevich. And thank you to Joe Ingles, reporter for the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau. Thanks, Joe.
Thanks for having me.
Haley B. Miller, politics reporter at the Columbus Dispatch. Thanks, Haley.
Thank you.
And Noah Blundo, reporter and editor at Hannah News Service. Thanks, Noah.
Thanks again.
And this has been the Reporter Roundtable on 89.7 NPR News. Thanks for joining us.